Side 20, It, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 743.
Yeah, if I breathe smoke for 5 or 6 hours, I'd probably have some visions all right, Mike said, and they all laughed.
The visions were supposed to tell the tribe what to do, Ben said. And I don't know if this part is true or not, but the book said that most times the visions were right.
A silence fell, and Richie looked at Bill. He was aware that they were all looking at Bill, and he had the feeling, again, that Ben's story of the smoke hole was more than a thing you read about in a book and then had to try for yourself, like a chemistry experiment or a magic trick. He knew it, they all knew it. Perhaps Ben knew it most of all. This was something they were supposed to do. They were supposed to have visions. Most times, the visions were right.
Richie thought, I'll bet if we asked him, Haystack would tell us that book practically jumped into his hand, like something wanted him to read that one particular book, and then tell us about the smoke hole ceremony, because there's a tribe right here, isn't there? Yeah, us. And yeah, I guess we do need to know what happens next.
This thought led to another. Was this supposed to happen?
From the time Ben got the idea for an underground clubhouse instead of a treehouse, was this supposed to happen? How much of this are we thinking up ourselves, and how much is being thought up for us?
In a way, he supposed such an idea should have been almost comforting. It was nice to imagine that something bigger than you, smarter than you, was doing your thinking for you, like the adults that planned your meals, bought your clothes, and managed your time. And Richie was convinced that the force that had brought them together, the force that had used Ben as its messenger to bring them the idea of the smoke hole, that force wasn't the same as the one killing the children. This was some kind of counterforce to that other, to...
Oh, well, you might as well say it.
It. But all the same, he didn't like this feeling of not being in control of his own actions, of being managed, of being run. They all looked at Bill. They all waited to see what Bill would say.
You no, he said. That sounds really neat.
Beverly sighed and Stan stirred uncomfortably. That was all.
Really neat,
Bill repeated, looking down at his hands, and perhaps it was only the uneasy flashlight beam in Ben's hands or his own imagination, but Richie thought Bill looked a little pale and a lot scared, although he was smiling.
Maybe we could use a vision to tell us what to do about our problem.
And if anyone has a vision, Richie thought, it will be Bill.
But about that, he was wrong.
Well, Ben said, it probably only works for Indians, but it might be flippy to try it.
Yeah, we'll probably all pass out from the smoke and die in here, Stan said gloomily. That'd be really flippy, all right.
You don't want to, Stan? Eddie asked.
Well, I sort of do, Stan said. He sighed.
I think you guys are making me crazy, you know it.
He looked at Bill.
When?
Bill said, well, no time like the present, is there?
There was a startled, thoughtful silence. Then Richie got to his feet, straight-arming the trap door open and letting in the muted light of that still summer day.
I got my hatchet, Ben said, following him out. Who wants to help me cut some green wood?
In the end, they all helped.
3.
It took them about an hour to get ready. They cut 4 or 5 armloads of small green branches from which Ben had stripped the twigs and leaves.
They'll smoke all right, he said. I don't even know if we'll be able to get them going.
Beverly and Richie went down to the bank of the Kanduskeag and brought back a collection of good-sized stones, using Eddie's jacket. His mother always made him take a jacket, even if it was 80 degrees. It might rain, Mrs. Kasprak said, and if you have a jacket to put on, your skin won't get soaked if it does, as a makeshift sling. Carrying the rocks back to the clubhouse, Richie said,
You can't do this, Bev. You're a girl.
Ben said it was just the braves that went down on the smoke hole, not the squaws. Beverly paused, looking at Richie with mixed amusement and irritation. A lock of hair had escaped from her ponytail. She pushed out her lower lip and blew it off her forehead.
I could wrestle you to a fall any day, Richie, and you know it.
That don't matter, Miss Scarlet,
Richie said, popping his eyes at her. You was still a girl, and you was always gonna be a girl. You sure ain't no Injun brave.
I'll be a bravette then, Beverly said.
Now, are we going to take these rocks back to the clubhouse, or am I going to bounce a few of them off your asshole skull?
Lawks a mussy, Miss Scarlet. I ain't got no asshole in my skull.
Richie screeched, and Beverly laughed so hard she dropped her end of Eddie's jacket and all the stones fell out. She scolded Richie all the time they were picking them up again, and Richie joked and screeched in many voices and thought to himself how beautiful she was. Although Richie had not been serious when he spoke of excluding her from the smoke hole on the basis of her sex, Bill Denbro apparently was. She stood facing him, her hands on her hips, her cheeks flushed with anger.
You can just take that and stuff it with a long pole, stuttering Bill. I'm in on this too, or aren't I a member of your lousy club anymore?
Patiently, Bill said,
It's not like that, Bev, and you know it. Somebody has to stay up here. Why?
Bill tried, but the roadblock was in again. He looked at Eddie for help.
It's what Stan said, Eddie told her quietly, about the smoke.
Bill says that might really happen. We could pass out down there. Then we'd die. Bill says that's what happens to most people in house fires. They don't burn up. They choke to death in the smoke. They... Now she turned to Eddie.
Well, okay. He wants somebody to stay up on top in case there's trouble?
Miserably, Eddie nodded.
Well, what about you? You're the one with the asthma.
Eddie said nothing. She turned back to Bill. The others stood around, hands in their pockets, looking at their sneakers.
It's because I'm a girl, isn't it? That's really it, isn't it? Bet.
You don't have to talk, she snapped. Just nod your head or shake it. Your head doesn't stutter, does it?
Is it because I'm a girl?
Reluctantly, Bill nodded his head. She looked at him for a moment, her lips trembling, and Richie thought she would cry. Instead, she exploded.
Well, fuck you!
She whirled around to look at the others, and they flinched from her gaze, so hot it was nearly radioactive.
Fuck all of you if you think the same thing!
She turned back to Bill and began to talk fast, rapping him with words. This is something more than some diddly shit kids game like tag or guns or hide-and-go-seek, and you know it, Bill.
We're supposed to do this. That's part of it. And you're not going to cut me out just because I'm a girl. Do you understand?
You better, or I'm leaving right now. And if I go, I'm gone. For good. You understand? She stopped. Bill looked at her. He seemed to have regained his calm, but Richie felt afraid. He felt that any chance they had of winning, of finding a way to get to the thing that had killed Georgie Denbro and the other kids, getting to it and killing it, was now in jeopardy.
7, Richie thought. That's the magic number. There has to be 7 of us. That's the way it's supposed to be.
A bird sang somewhere, stopped, sang again.
All were right,
Bill said, and Richie let his breath out.
But somebody has to stay to Hopside. Who wants to do it?
Richie thought Eddie or Stan would surely volunteer for this duty, but Eddie said nothing. Stan stood pale and thoughtful and silent. Mike had his thumbs hooked into his belt like Steve McQueen and Wanted Dead or Alive, nothing moving but his eyes.
Come on, Bill said.
And Richie realized that all pretense had gone out of the thing now. Bev's impassioned speech and Bill's grave, too old face had seen to that. This was a part of it, perhaps as dangerous as the expedition he and Bill had made to the house at 29 Niebolt Street. They knew it, and no one was backing down. Suddenly he was very proud of them, very proud to be with them. After all the years of being counted out, he was counted in, finally counted in. He didn't know if they were still losers or not. But he knew they were together. They were friends, damn good friends. Richie took his glasses off and rubbed them vigorously with the tail of his shirt.
I know how to do it, Bev said, and took a book of matches from her pocket.
On the front, so tiny you'd need a magnifying glass to get a really good look at them, were pictures of that year's candidates for the title of Miss Rheingold. Beverly lit a match and then blew it out. She tore out 6 more and added the burned match. She turned away from them, and when she turned back, the white ends of the 7 matches poked out of her closed fist.
Pick,
she said, holding the matches out to Bill. The one who picks the match with the burned head stays up here and pulls the rest out if they go flippy. Bill looked at her levelly.
This is how you want it?
She smiled at him then, and her smile made her face radiant.
Yeah, you big dummy, this is how I want it. What about you?
I love you, Bev, he said, and color rose in her cheeks like hasty flames. Bill did not appear to notice. He studied the match tails sticking out of her fist, and at length he picked one. Its head was blue and unburned. She turned to Ben and offered the remaining six.
"I love you too," Ben said hoarsely. His face was plum-colored.
He looked like he was on the verge of a stroke, but no one laughed. Somewhere deeper in the barrens, the bird sang again.
Stan would know what it was, Richie thought randomly.
"Thank you,"
she said, smiling, and Ben picked a match. Its head was unburned. She offered them to Eddie next. Eddie smiled, a shy smile that was incredibly sweet and almost heartbreakingly vulnerable.
"I guess I love you too, Bev,"
he said, and then picked a match blindly. Its head was blue. Beverly now offered the four match tails in her hand to Richie.
"I loves you, Miss Scarlet,"
Richie screamed at the top of his voice and made exaggerated kissing gestures with his lips. Beverly only looked at him, smiling a little, and Richie suddenly felt ashamed.
"I do love you, Bev," he said and touched her hair. "You're cool."
"Thank you," she said.
He picked a match and looked at it, positive he'd picked the burned one, but he hadn't. She offered them to Stan.
"I love you," Stan said, and plucked one of the matches from her fist.
Unburned.
"You and me, Mike," she said, and offered him his pick of the two left.
He stepped forward.
"I don't know you well enough to love you," he said, "but I love you anyway. You could give my mother shouting lessons, I guess."
They all laughed, and Mike took a match. Its head was also unburned.
"I guess it's you after all, Bev," Bill said.
Looking disgusted, all that flash and fire for nothing, Beverly opened her hand. The head of the remaining match was also blue and unburned.
You jiggered them, Bill accused.
"No, I didn't."
Her tone was not one of angry protest, which would have been suspect, but flabbergasted surprise.
"Honest to God, I didn't."
Then she showed them her palm. They all saw the faint mark of soot from the burned match head there.
"Bill, I swear in my mother's name."
Bill looked at her for a moment and then nodded. By common, unspoken consent, they all handed the matches back to Bill. Seven of them, their heads intact. Stan and Eddie began to crawl around on the ground, but there was no burned match there.
"I didn't,"
Beverly said again, to no one in particular.
"So what do we do now?" Richie asked.
"We all go down," Bill said, "because that's what we're supposed to do."
"And if we all pass out?" Eddie asked.
Bill looked at Beverly again.
"If Bev's to telling the truth, and she is, we won't."
"How do you know?" Stan asked.
I just to do.
The bird sang again.
4.
Ben and Richie went down first, and the others handed the rocks down one by one. Richie passed them on to Ben, who made a small stone circle in the middle of the dirt clubhouse floor.
"Okay," he said, "that's enough."
The others came down, each with a handful of green twigs they'd cut with Ben's hatchet. Bill came last. He closed the trap door and opened the narrow hinged window.
There, he said. There's our smoke hole.
Do we have any kindling?
You can use this if you want,
Mike said, and took a battered Archie funny book out of his hip pocket.
I read it already.
Bill tore the pages out of the funny book one by one, working slowly and gravely. The others sat around the walls, knee to knee and shoulder to shoulder, watching, not speaking. The tension was thick and still. Bill laid small twigs and branches over the paper and then looked at Beverly.
You got the matches? He said.
She lit one, a tiny yellow flare in the gloom.
Darn thing probably won't catch anyway, she said in a slightly uneven voice and touched a light to the paper in several places.
When the match flame got close to her fingers, she tossed it into the center. The flames blazed up yellow, crackling, throwing their faces into sharp relief, and in that moment Richie had no trouble believing Ben's Indian story. And he thought it must have been like this back in those old days, when the idea of white men was still no more than a rumor or a tall tale to those Indians who followed buffalo herds so big they could cover the earth from horizon to horizon. Herds so big that their passing shook the ground like an earthquake. In that moment, Richie could picture those Indians, Kiowas or Pawnees or whatever they were, down in their smoke hole, knee to knee and shoulder to shoulder, watching as the flames guttered and sank into the green wood like hot sores, listening to the faint and steady sss of sap oozing out of the damp wood, waiting for the vision to descend.
Yeah, sitting here now, he could believe it all.
And looking at their somber faces as they studied the flame and the charring pages of Mike's Archie funny book, He could see that they believed it, too. The branches were catching. The clubhouse began to fill up with smoke. Some of it, white as cotton smoke signals in a Saturday matinee movie starring Randolph Scott or Audie Murphy, escaped from the smoke hole. But with no moving air outside to create a draft, most of it stayed below. It had an acrid bite that made eyes sting and throats throb. Richie heard Eddie cough twice, a flat sound like dry boards being whacked together, and then fall silent again. He shouldn't be down here, he thought, but something else apparently felt otherwise. Bill tossed another handful of green twigs on the smoldering fire and asked in a thin voice that was not much like his usual speaking voice, "Anyone having any visions?" "Visions of getting out of here," Stan Ura said. Beverly laughed at this, but her laughter turned into a fit of coughing and choking. Richie leaned his head back against the wall and looked up at the smoke hole, a thin rectangle of mellow white light. He thought about the Paul Bunyan statue that day in March. But that had only been a mirage, a hallucination, a vision.
"Smoke's killing me," Ben said. "Woo!"
"So leave," Richie murmured, not taking his eyes off the smoke hole. He felt as if he was getting a handle on this. He felt as if he had lost 10 pounds. And he sure as shit felt as if the clubhouse had gotten bigger. Damn straight on that last. He had been sitting with Ben Hanscom's fat right leg squashed against his left one and Bill Denbro's bony left shoulder socked into his right arm. Now he was touching neither of them. He glanced lazily to his right and left to verify that his perception was true, and it was. Ben was a foot or so to his left. On his right, Bill was even farther away. "Place is bigger, friends and neighbors," he said. He took a deeper breath and coughed hard. It hurt, hurt deep in his chest, the way a cough hurt when you had the flu or the grip or something. For a while he thought it would never pass, that he would just go on coughing until they had to pull him out. "If they still can," he thought. But the thought was really too dim to be frightening. Then Bill was pounding him on the back and the coughing fit passed. "You don't know you don't always," Richie said. He was looking at the smoke hole again instead of at Bill. How bright it seemed. When he closed his eyes, he could still see the rectangle floating there in the dark, but bright green instead of bright white.
Well, what do you mean?
Bill asked.
Stutter.
He paused, aware that someone else was coughing, but not sure who it was.
You ought to do the voices, not me, Big Bill. You...
The coughing got louder. Suddenly the clubhouse was flooded with daylight, so sudden and so bright Richie had to squint against it. He could just make out Stan Uris climbing and clawing his way out.
"Sorry,"
Stan managed, through his spasmodic coughing.
"Sorry, can't..."
"It's all right," Richie heard himself say. "You don't need no stinking batches." His voice sounded as if it were coming from a different body. The trapdoor slammed shut a moment later, but enough fresh air had come in to clear his head a little. Before Ben moved over a little to fill the space Stan had vacated, Richie became aware of Ben's leg again, pressing his. How had he gotten the idea that the clubhouse had gotten bigger? Mike Hanlon threw more sticks on the smoky fire. Richie resumed taking shallow breaths and looking up at the smoke hole. He had no sense of real time passing, but he was vaguely aware that, in addition to the smoke, the clubhouse was getting good and hot. He looked around, looked at his friends. They were hard to see, half swallowed in shadow smoke and still white summer light. Bev's head was tilted back against a piece of shoring, her hands on her knees, her eyes closed, tears trickling down her cheeks toward her earlobes. Bill was sitting cross-legged, his chin on his chest. Ben was... But suddenly Ben was getting to his feet, pushing the trap door open again.
"There goes Ben," Mike said.
He was sitting Indian fashion directly across from Richie, his eyes as red as a weasel's. Comparative coolness struck them again. The air freshened as smoke swirled up through the trap. Ben was coughing and dry retching. He pulled himself out with Stan's help, and before either of them could close the trapdoor, Eddie was staggering to his feet, his face a deadly pale except for the bruised-looking patches under his eyes and traced just below his cheekbones. His thin chest was hitching up and down in quick, shallow spasms. He groped weakly for the edge of the escape hatch and would have fallen if Ben had not grabbed one hand and Stan the other.
"Sorry,"
Eddie managed in a squeaky little whisper, and then they hauled him up. The trap door banged down again. There was a long, quiet period. The smoke built up until it was a thick, still fog in the clubhouse.
"Looks like a pea super to me, Watson," Richie thought,
and for a moment he imagined himself as Sherlock Holmes, a Holmes who looked a great deal like Basil Rathbone and who was totally black and white, moving purposefully along Baker Street. Moriarty was somewhere near, a hansom cab awaited, and the game was afoot. The thought was amazingly clear, amazingly solid. It seemed almost to have weight, as if it were not a little pocket daydream of the sort he had all the time, batting cleanup for the Bow Sox, bottom of the ninth, bases loaded, and there it goes, it's up, it's gone. Home run, Tozier, and that breaks the Babe's record. But something that was almost real. There was still enough of the wiseacre in him to think that if all he was getting out of this was a vision of Basil Rathbone as Sherlock Holmes, then the whole idea of visions was pretty overrated. Except, of course, it isn't Moriarty that's out there. It's out there. Some it, and it's real. It... Then the trap door opened again, and Beverly was struggling her way out, coughing dryly, one hand cupped over her mouth. Ben got one hand, and Stan grabbed her under the other arm. Half pulled, half scrambling under her own power, she was up and gone.
It is the Higger, Bill said.
Richie looked around. He saw the circle of stones with the fire smoldering within, fuming out clouds of smoke. Across the way, he saw Mike sitting cross-legged like a totem carved from mahogany, staring at him through the fire with his smoke-reddened eyes. Except Mike was better than 20 yards away, and Bill was even farther away on Richie's right. The underground clubhouse was now at least the size of a ballroom.
Doesn't matter, Mike said. It's going to come pretty quick. Something is.
Yeah, Bill said. But I...
He began to cough. He tried to control it, but the cough worsened, a dry rattling. Dimly, Richie saw Bill stumble to his feet, lunge for the trap door, and shove it open.
Good la-la-la.
And then he was gone, dragged up by the others.
Looks like it's you and me, old Mikey, Richie said, and then he began to cough himself. I thought for sure that it would be Bill.
The cough worsened. He doubled over, hacking dryly, unable to get his breath. His head was thudding, whacking, like a turnip filled with blood. His eyes teared behind his glasses. From far away, he heard Mike saying, "Go on up if you have to, Richie. Don't go flippy. Don't kill yourself." He raised a hand toward Mike and flapped it at him.
"No stinking batches,"
in a negative gesture. Little by little, he began to get the coughing under control again. Mike was right. Something was going to happen, and soon. He wanted to still be here when it did. He tilted his head back and looked up at the smoke hole again. The coughing fit had left him feeling lightheaded, and now he seemed to be floating on a cushion of air. It was a pleasant feeling. He took shallow breaths and thought,
"Someday I'm going to be a rock and roll star. That's it, yes, I'll be famous. I'll make records and albums and movies. I'll have a black sport coat and white shoes and a yellow Cadillac. And when I come back to Derry, they'll all eat their hearts out, even Bowers. I wear glasses, but what the fuck? Buddy Holly wears glasses. I'll bop till I'm blue and dance till I'm black. I'll be the first rock and roll star to ever come from Maine. I'll..."
The thought drifted away. It didn't matter. He found that now he didn't need to take shallow breaths. His lungs had adapted. He could breathe as much smoke as he wanted. Maybe he was from Venus. Mike threw more sticks on the fire. Not to be outdone, Richie tossed on another handful himself.
"How you feeling, Rich?" Mike asked.
Richie smiled.
"Better. Good, almost. You?"
Mike nodded and smiled back.
"I feel okay. Have you been having some funny thoughts?"
"Yeah. Thought I was Sherlock Holmes for a minute there. Then I thought I could dance like the Dovells."
"Your eyes are so red you wouldn't believe it, you know it?"
"Yours too. Just a couple of weasels in the pen, that's what we are."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah."
"You want to say all right?"
"All right. You want to say you got the word?"
"I got it, Mikey."
"Yeah, okay." They grinned at each other, and then Richie let his head tilt back against the wall again and looked up at the smoke hole. Shortly, he began to drift away. No, not away. Up. He was drifting up. Like,
"Float down, here we all.
A balloon."
"You guys all were right?"
Bill's voice coming down through the smoke hole. "Coming from Venus, worried." Richie felt himself thud back down inside himself.
"All right,"
he heard his voice, distant, irritated.
"All right, we said all right. Be quiet, Bill. Let us get the word. We want to say we got the
world.
Word."
The clubhouse was bigger than ever, floored now in some polished wood.
The smoke was fog thick, and it was hard to see the fire.
That floor, Jesus come please us. It was as big as a ballroom floor in an MGM musical extravaganza.
Mike looked at him from the other side, a shape almost lost in the fog.
You coming, old Mikey?
Right here with you, Richie.
You still want to say all right?
Yeah, but hold my hand. Can you catch hold?
I think so.
Richie held his hand out, and although Mike was on the far side of this enormous room, he felt those strong brown fingers close over his wrist.
Oh, that was good. That was a good touch. Good to find desire in comfort, to find comfort in desire, to find substance in smoke, and smoke in substance.
He tilted his head back and looked at the smoke hole, so white and wee. It was farther up now, miles up, Venusian skylight. It was happening. He began to float.
Come on, then,
he thought, and began to rise faster through the smoke, the fog, the mist, whatever it was. 5. They weren't inside anymore. The two of them were standing together in the middle of the barrens, and it was nearly dusk. It was the barrens, he knew that, but everything was different. The foliage was lusher, deeper, savagely fragrant. There were plants he had never seen before, and Richie realized some of the things he had first taken for trees were really giant ferns. There was the sound of running water, but it was much louder than it should have been. This water sounded not like the leisurely flow of the Kanduskeag stream, but more the way he imagined the Colorado River would sound as it cut its way through the Grand Canyon. It was hot, too. Not that it didn't get hot in Maine during the summer, and humid enough so that sometimes you felt sticky just lying in your bed at night, but this was more heat and more humidity than he had ever felt in his whole life. A low mist, smoky and thick, lay in the hollows of the land and crept around the boy's legs. It had a thin, acrid smell like burning green wood. He and Mike began to move toward the sound of the running water without speaking, pushing their way through the strange foliage. Thick, ropey lianas lay between some of the trees like spidery hammocks, and once Richie heard something go crashing off through the underbrush. It sounded bigger than a deer. He stopped long enough to look around, turning in a circle, studying the horizon. He knew where the standpipe's thick white cylinder should have been, but it wasn't there. Neither was the railroad trestle going over the train yards at the end of Niebold Street, or the old Cape housing development. Low bluffs and red sandstone outcroppings of rock bulged out of thick stands of giant fern and pine trees where the old Cape should have been. There was a flapping noise overhead. The boys ducked as a squadron of bats flapped by. They were the biggest bats Richie had ever seen, and for a moment he was more terrified than he had been even when Bill was trying to get Silver rolling and he had heard the werewolf closing in on them from behind. The stillness and the alienness of this land were both terrible, but its awful familiarity was somehow worse.
No need to be scared, he told himself. Remember that this is just a dream or a vision or whatever you want to call it. Me and old Mikey are really back in the clubhouse, goofed up on smoke. Pretty soon, Big Bill is going to get nervous from the soibus because we're not answering anymore, and he and Ben will come down and haul us out. It's just like Conway Twitty says, only make-believe.
But he could see how one of the bat's wings was so ragged the hazy sun shone through it, and when they passed beneath one of the giant ferns, he could see a fat yellow caterpillar trundling across a wide green frond, leaving its shadow behind it. There were tiny black mites jumping and sizzling on the caterpillar's body. If this was a dream, it was the clearest one he had ever had. They went on toward the sound of the water, and in the thick knee-high ground mist, Richie was unable to tell if his feet were touching the ground or not. They came to a place where both the mist and the ground stopped. Richie looked, unbelieving. This was not the Kanduskeag, and yet it was. The stream boiled and roiled through a narrow water course cut through that same crumbly rock. Looking across to the far side, he could see ages cut into those stacked layers of stone, red and then orange and then red again. You couldn't walk across this stream on stepping stones. You'd need a rope bridge, and if you fell in, you would be swept away at once. The sound of the water was the sound of bitter, foolish anger, and as Richie watched, slack-jawed, he saw a pinkish silver fish jump in an impossibly high arc, snapping at the bugs that made shifting clouds just above the surface of the water. It splashed down again, giving Richie just time enough to register its presence and to realize he had never seen a fish exactly like that in his whole life, not even in a book. Birds flocked across the sky, squalling harshly. Not a dozen or two dozen. For a moment the sky was so dark with birds that they blotted out the sun. Something else crashed through the bushes,
and then more things. Richie wheeled, his heart thudding painfully in his chest, and saw something that looked like an antelope flash by, heading southeast.
Something's going to happen, and they know it.
The birds passed, presumably alighting somewhere en masse farther south. Another animal crashed by them, and another. Then there was silence except for the steady rumble of the Kanduskeag. The silence had a waiting quality about it, a pregnant quality Richie didn't like. He felt the hairs shifting and trying to stand up on the back of his neck, and he groped for Mike's hand again.
"Do you know where we are?" he shouted at Mike. "You got the word?"
"Jesus, yes," Mike shouted back. "I got it. This is a go, Richie. A go."
Richie nodded. A go, as in once upon a time, long, long ago, when we all lived in the forest and nobody lived anywhere else. They were in the barrens as they had been God knew how many thousands of years ago. They were in some unimaginable past before the Ice Age, when New England had been as tropical as South America was today. If there still was a today. He looked around again, nervously, almost expecting to see a brontosaurus raise its crane-like neck against the sky and stare down at them, its mouth full of mud and dripping uprooted plants, or a saber-toothed tiger come stalking out of the undergrowth. But there was only that silence, as in the 5 or 10 minutes before a vicious thunder squall strikes, when the purple heads stack up and up in the sky overhead, and the light turns a queer, bruised purple-yellow, and the wind dies completely, and you can smell a thick aroma like overcharged car batteries in the air. We're in the ago, 1 million years back, maybe, or 10 million, or 80 million. But here we are, and something's going to happen. I don't know what, but something. And I'm scared, and I want it to end, and I want to be back. And Bill, please pull us out. It's like we fell into the picture. Some picture. Please help. Mike's hand tightened on his, and he realized that now the silence had been broken. There was a steady low vibration. He could feel it more than hear it, working against the tight flesh of his eardrums, buzzing the tiny bones that conducted the sound. It grew steadily. It had no tone. It simply was. The word in the beginning was the word, the world, the... A tuneless, soulless sound. He groped for the tree they stood near, and as his hand touched it, cupped the curve of the hole, he could feel the vibration caught inside. At the same moment, he realized he could feel it in his feet, a steady tingling that went up his ankles and calves to his knees, turning his tendons into tuning forks. It grew and grew. It was coming out of the sky. Not wanting to but unable to help himself, Richie turned his face up. The sun was a molten coin burning a circle in the low-hanging overcast, surrounded by a fairy ring of moisture. Below it, the verdant green slash that was the barrens lay utterly still. Richie thought he understood what this vision was. They were about to see the coming of it. The vibration took on a voice, a rumbling roar that built to a shattering crescendo of sound. He clapped his hands to his ears and screamed and could not hear himself scream. Beside him, Mike Hanlon was doing the same, and Richie saw that Mike's nose was bleeding a little. The clouds in the west lit with a bloom of red fire. It traced its way toward them, widening from an artery to a stream to a river of ominous color, and then, as a burning falling object broke through the cloud cover, the wind came. It was hot and searing, smoky and suffocating. The thing in the sky was gigantic, a flaming matchhead that was nearly too bright to look at. Arcs of electricity bolted from it, blue bullwhips that flashed out from it and left thunder in their wake.
"A spaceship!"
Richie screamed, falling to his knees and covering his eyes.
"Oh my God, it's a spaceship!"
But he believed, and would tell the others later, as best he could, that it was not a spaceship, although it might have come through space to get here. Whatever came down on that long-ago day had come from a place much farther away than another star or another galaxy, and if spaceship was the first word to come into his mind, perhaps that was only because his mind had no other way of grasping what his eyes were seeing. There was an explosion then, a roar of sound followed by a rolling concussion that knocked them both down. This time it was Mike who groped for Richie's hand. There was another explosion. Richie opened his eyes and saw a glare of fire and a pillar of smoke rising into the sky.
"It!"
he screamed at Mike, in an ecstasy of terror now. Never in his life, before or after, would he feel any emotion so deeply, be so overwhelmed by feeling.
"It! It! It!"
Mike dragged him to his feet, and they ran along the high bank of the young Kanduskeag, never noticing how close they were to the drop. Once Mike stumbled and went skidding to his knees. Then it was Richie's turn to go down, barking his shin and tearing his pants. The wind had come up, and it was pushing the smell of the burning forest toward them. The smoke grew thicker, and Richie became dimly aware that he and Mike were not running alone. The animals were on the move again, fleeing from the smoke, the fire, the death in the fire. Running from it, perhaps. The new arrival in their world. Richie began to cough. He could hear Mike beside him, also coughing. The smoke was thicker, washing out the greens and grays and reds of the day. Mike fell again, and Richie lost his hand. He groped for it and could not find it.
Mike!
He screamed, panicked, coughing. Mike, where are you?
Mike!
Mike! But Mike was gone. Mike was nowhere.
Richie! Richie! Richie!
Wacko!
Richie! Richie! Are you...
Six.
All right?
His eyes fluttered open, and he saw Beverly kneeling beside him, wiping his mouth with a handkerchief. The others, Bill, Eddie, Stan, and Ben, stood behind her, their faces solemn and scared. The side of Richie's face hurt like hell. He tried to speak to Beverly and could only croak. He tried to clear his throat and almost vomited. His throat and lungs felt as if they had somehow been lined with smoke. At last he managed.
"Did you slap me, Beverly?"
"It was all I could think of to do," she said.
"Wacko,"
Richie muttered.
"I didn't think you were going to be all right is all," Bev said, and suddenly burst into tears.
Richie patted her clumsily on the shoulder, and Bill put a hand on the back of her neck. She reached around at once, took it, squeezed it. Richie managed to sit up. The world began to swim in waves. When it steadied down, he saw Mike leaning against a tree nearby, his face dazed and ashy pale.
"Did I puke?"
Richie asked Bev. She nodded, still crying. In a croaking, stumbling Irish cop's voice, he asked,
"Get any on ye, darlin'?"
Bev laughed through her tears and shook her head.
"I turned you on your side. I was afraid. Afraid you'd choke on it."
She began to cry hard again.
No fair, Bill said, still holding her hand. I'm the one who hutters around here.
"Not bad, Big Bill," Richie said. He tried to get to his feet and sat down again heavily. The world was still swimming. He began to cough and turned his head away, aware that he was going to retch again only a moment before it happened. He threw up a mess of green foam and thick saliva that mostly came out in ropes. He closed his eyes tight and croaked,
"Anyone want a snack?"
"Oh, shit," Ben cried, disgusted and laughing at the same time.
"Looks more like puke to me,"
Richie said, although in truth his eyes were still tightly shut.
"The shit usually comes out the other end, at least for me. I don't know about you, Haystack."
When he opened his eyes at last, he saw the clubhouse about 20 yards away. Both the window and the big trap door were thrown open. Smoke, thinning now, puffed from both. This time Richie was able to get to his feet. For a moment he was quite sure he was going to retch again, or faint, or both.
"Wacko,"
he murmured, watching the world waver and warp in front of his eyes. When the feeling passed, he made his way over to where Mike was. Mike's eyes were still weasel red, and from the dampness on his pants cuffs, Richie thought that maybe old Mikey had taken a ride on the stomach elevator, too.
"For a white boy, you did pretty good,"
Mike croaked, and punched Richie weakly on the shoulder. Richie was at a loss for words, a condition of exquisite rarity. Bill came over. The others came with him.
"You pulled us out?"
Richie asked.
"Me and Ben. You were screaming. But both of you, but...
He looked over at Ben. Ben said,
"It must have been the smoke, Bill."
But there was no conviction in the big boy's voice at all. Flatly, Richie said,
"You mean what I think you mean?"
Bill shrugged.
Well, what's to that, Richie?
Mike answered,
"We weren't there at first, were we? You went down because you heard us screaming, but at first we weren't there."
"It was really smoky," Ben said. "Hearing you both screaming that way, that was scary enough. But the screaming, it sounded, well,
it sounded very far away," Bill said.
Stuttering badly, he told them that when he and Ben had gone down, they hadn't been able to see either Richie or Mike. They had gone plunging around in the smoky clubhouse, panicked, scared that if they didn't act quickly, the two boys might die of smoke poisoning. At last, Bill had gripped a hand, Richie's. He had given a hell of a yank, and Richie had come flying out of the gloom, only about one quarter conscious. When Bill turned around, he had seen Ben with Mike in a bear hug, both of them coughing. Ben had thrown Mike up and out of the trap door. Ben listened to all this, nodding.
I kept grabbing, you know, really not doing anything except jabbing my hand out like I wanted to shake hands. You grabbed it, Mike. Damn good thing you grabbed it when you did. I think you were just about gone.
You guys make the clubhouse sound a lot bigger than it is, Richie said.
Talking about stumbling around in it and all, it's only 5 feet on every side.
There was a moment's silence when they all looked at Bill, who stood in frowning concentration.
It was a bigger, he said at last.
Wasn't it, Ben?
Ben shrugged. It sure seemed like it, unless it was the smoke.
It wasn't the smoke, Richie said. Just before it happened, before we went out, I remember thinking it was at least as big as a ballroom in a movie. Like one of those musicals, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, something like that. I could barely see Mike against the other wall.
Before you went out? Beverly asked.
Well, what I mean, like...
She grabbed Richie's arm.
It happened, didn't it? It really happened. You had a vision, just like in Ben's book.
Her face was glowing. It really happened.
Richie looked down at himself, and then at Mike. One of the knees of Mike's corduroy pants was out, and both the knees of his own jeans were torn. He could look through the holes and see bleeding scrapes on both his knees.
If it was a vision, I never want to have another one, he said.
I don't know about the kingfish over there, but when I went down there, I didn't have any holes in my pants. They're practically new, for gosh sakes. My mom's going to give me hell.
What happened?
Ben and Eddie asked together. Richie and Mike exchanged a glance, and then Richie said,
Bevy, you got a smoke?
She had two, wrapped in a piece of tissue. Richie put one of them in his mouth, and when she lit it, the first drag made him cough so badly that he handed it back to her.
Can't, he said. Sorry.
It was the past, Mike said.
Shit on that, Richie said. It wasn't just the past. It was a go.
Yeah, right. We were in the Barrens, but the Kandusky was going a mile a minute. It was deep. It was fucking wild.
Sorry, Bevy, but it was. And there were fish in it. Salmon, I think.
My dad says that there haven't been any fish in the Kandusky for a little long time.
But because of the sewage.
This was a long time, all right, Richie said. He looked around at them uncertainly.
I think it was a million years ago, at least.
A thunderstruck silence greeted this. Beverly broke it at last.
But what happened?
Richie felt the words in his throat, but he had to struggle to bring them out. It felt almost like vomiting again.
We saw it come, he said at last. I think that was it.
Christ, Stan muttered.
Oh, Christ.
There was a sharp hiss gasp as Eddie used his aspirator.
It came out of the sky, Mike said. I never want to see anything like that again in my whole life. It was burning so hot you couldn't really look at it. And it was throwing off electricity and making thunder. The noise.
He shook his head and looked at Richie.
It sounded like the end of the world. And when it hit, it started a forest fire. That was the end of it.
Was it a spaceship? Ben asked.
Yes, Richie said.
No, Mike said. They looked at each other.
Well, I guess it was, Mike said.
And at the same time, Richie said, No, it really wasn't a spaceship, you know, but... They paused again while the others looked at them, perplexed.
You tell, Richie said to Mike. We mean the same thing, I think, but they're not getting it.
Mike coughed into his fist and then looked up at the others, almost apologetically.
I don't know how to tell you, he said.
To try, Bill said urgently.
It came out of the sky, Mike repeated, but it wasn't a spaceship, exactly. It wasn't a meteor, either. It was more like, like the Ark of the Covenant in the Bible that was supposed to have the Spirit of God inside of it. Except this wasn't God. Just feeling it, watching it come, you knew it meant bad, that it was bad.
He looked at them.
Richie nodded. It came from outside. I got that feeling, from outside.
Outside where, Richie?
Eddie asked.
Outside everything, Richie said. And when it came down, it made the biggest damn hole you ever saw in your life. It turned this big hill into a donut, just about. It landed right where the downtown part of Derry is now.
He looked at them.
Do you get it?
Beverly dropped the cigarette, half-smoked, and crushed it out under one shoe. Mike said,
It's always been here, since the beginning of time. Since before there were men anywhere. Unless maybe there were just a few of them in Africa somewhere, swinging through the trees or living in caves. The crater's gone now, and the Ice Age probably scraped the valley deeper and changed some stuff around and filled the crater in. But it was here then, sleeping maybe, waiting for the ice to melt, waiting for the people to come.
That's why it uses the sewers and the drains, Richie put in. They must be regular freeways for it.
You didn't see what it looked like? Stan Uris asked abruptly and a little hoarsely. They shook their heads.
Can we beat it? Eddie said in the silence. A thing like that?
No one answered.
Chapter 16. Eddie's Bad Break. 1. By the time Richie finishes, they're all nodding. Eddie is nodding along with them, remembering along with them, when the pain suddenly races up his left arm.
Races up?
No, rips through. It feels as if someone is trying to sharpen a rusty saw on the bone in there. He grimaces and reaches into the pocket of his sport jacket, sorts through a number of bottles by feel, and takes out the Excedrin. He swallows two with a gulp of gin and prune juice. The arm has been paining him off and on all day. At first he dismissed it as the twinges of bursitis he sometimes gets when the weather is damp. But halfway through Richie's story, a new memory clicks into place for him and he understands the pain.
This isn't memory lane we're wandering down anymore, he thinks. It's getting more and more like the Long Island Expressway.
5 years ago, during a routine checkup, Eddie has a routine checkup every 6 weeks, the doctor said matter-of-factly, There's an old break here, Ed. Did you fall out of a tree when you were a kid?
Something like that, Eddie agreed, not bothering to tell Dr. Robbins that his mother undoubtedly would have fallen down dead of a brain hemorrhage if she had seen or heard of Eddie climbing trees. The truth was, he hadn't been able to remember exactly how he broke the arm. It didn't seem important, although Eddie thinks now that lack of interest was in itself very odd. He is, after all, a man who attaches importance to a sneeze or a slight change in the color of his stools. But it was an old break, a minor irritation, something that happened a long time ago in a boyhood he could barely remember and didn't care to recall. It pained him a little when he had to drive long hours on rainy days. A couple of aspirin took care of it nicely, no big deal. But now it is not just a minor irritation. It is some madman sharpening that rusty saw, playing bone tunes, and he remembers that was how it felt in the hospital, especially late at night, in the first 3 or 4 days after it happened. Lying there in bed, sweating in the summer heat, waiting for the nurse to bring him a pill, tears running silently down his cheeks into the bowels of his ears, thinking, It's like some kook sharpening a saw in there. If this is memory lane, Eddie thinks, I'd trade it for one great big brain enema, a mental high colonic. Unaware he is going to speak, he says, It was Henry Bowers who broke my arm. Do you remember that? Mike nods. That was just before Patrick Hockstetter disappeared. I don't remember the date.
I do, Eddie says flatly. It was the 20th of July. The Hockstetter kid was reported missing on,
what, the 23rd?
22nd, Beverly Rogan says, although she doesn't tell them why she is so sure of the date. It is because she saw it take Hockstetter. Nor does she tell them that she believed then and believes now that Patrick Hockstetter was crazy, perhaps even crazier than Henry Bowers. She will tell them, but this is Eddie's turn. She will speak next, and then she supposes that Ben will narrate the climax of that July's events. The silver bullet they had never quite dared to make. A nightmare agenda, if ever there was one, she thinks. But that crazy exhilaration persists. When did she last feel this young? She can hardly sit still. The 20th of July, Eddie muses, rolling his aspirator along the table from one hand to the other. 3 or 4 days after the smoke hole thing. I spent the rest of the summer in a cast, remember? Richie slaps his forehead in a gesture they all remember from the old days, and Bill thinks, with a mixture of amusement and unease, that for a moment there Richie looked just like Beaver Cleaver.
Sure, of course. You were in a cast when we went to the house on Niebold Street, weren't you? And later, in the dark.
But now Richie shakes his head, a little puzzled.
What, Richie? Bill asks. Can't remember that part yet, Richie admits. Can you?
Bill shakes his head slowly.
Hockstetter was with them that day, Eddie says. It was the last time I ever saw him alive. Maybe he was a replacement for Peter Gordon. I guess Bowers didn't want Peter around anymore after he ran the day of the rock fight.
They all died, didn't they? Beverly asks quietly. After Jimmy Cohen, the only ones who died were Henry Bowers' friends, or his ex-friends.
All but Bowers, Mike agrees, glancing toward the balloons tethered to the microfilm recorder. And he's in Juniper Hill, a private insane asylum in Augusta.
Bill says, Well, what about when they broke your arm, Eddie?
Your stutter's getting worse, Big Bill, Eddie says solemnly, and finishes his drink in one gulp.
Never mind that, Bill says, to tell us.
Tell us, Beverly repeats, and puts her hand lightly on his arm. The pain flares there again.
All right, Eddie says. He pours himself a fresh drink, studies it, and says, It was a couple of days after I came home from the hospital that you guys came over to the house and showed me those silver ball bearings. You remember, Bill?
Bill nods.
Eddie looks at Beverly. Bill asked you if you'd shoot them if it came to that, because you had the best eye. I think you said you wouldn't, that you'd be too afraid. And you told us something else, but I just can't remember what it was. It's like...
Eddie sticks his tongue out and plucks the end of it as if something were stuck there. Richie and Ben both grin.
Was it something about Hockstetter?
Yes, Beverly says. I'll tell when you're done. Go ahead.
It was after that, after all you guys left, that my mother came in and we had a big fight. She didn't want me to hang around with any of you guys again. And she might have gotten me to agree. She had a way of working on a guy, you know.
Bill nods again. He remembers Mrs. Casbrack, a huge woman with a strange schizophrenic face, a face capable of looking stony and furious and miserable and frightened all at the same time.
Yeah, she might have got me to agree, Eddie says, but something else happened the same day Bowers broke my arm, something that really shook me up.
He utters a little laugh, thinking,
It shook me up all right. Is that all you can say? What's good talking when you can never tell people how you really feel? In a book or a movie, what I found out that day before Bowers broke my arm would have changed my life forever, and nothing would have happened the way it did. In a book or a movie, it would have set me free. In a book or a movie, I wouldn't have a whole suitcase full of pills back in my room at the townhouse. I wouldn't be married to Myra. I wouldn't have this stupid fucking aspirator here right now. In a book or a movie, because...
Suddenly, as they all watch, Eddie's aspirator rolls across the table by itself. As it rolls, it makes a dry, rattling sound, a little like maracas, a little like bones, a little like laughter. As it reaches the far side between Richie and Ben, it flips itself up into the air and falls on the floor. Richie makes a startled half-grab, and Bill cries sharply,
Don't touch it!
The balloons, Ben yells, and they all turn. Both balloons tethered to the microfilm recorder now read, Asthma medicine gives you cancer. Below the slogan are grinning skulls. They explode with twin bangs. Eddie looks at this, mouth dry, the familiar sensation of suffocation starting to tighten down in his chest like locking bolts. Bill looks back at him.
Who told you and what did they tell you?
Eddie licks his lips, wanting to go after his aspirator, not quite daring to. Who knew what might be in it now? He thinks about that day, the 20th, about how it was hot, about how his mother gave him a check, all filled out except for the amount, and a dollar in cash for himself, his allowance.
Mr. Keene,
he says, and his voice sounds distant to his own ears without power.
It was Mr. Keene.
Not exactly the nicest man in Derry, Mike says, but Eddie, lost in his thoughts, barely hears him.
Yes, it was hot that day, but cool inside the Center Street Drug, the wooden fans turning leisurely below the pressed tin ceiling,
and there was that comforting smell of mixed powders and nostrums. This was the place where they sold health. That was his mother's unstated but clearly communicated conviction. And with his body clock set at 11:30, Eddie had no suspicion that his mother might be wrong about that or anything else.
Well, Mr. Keene sure put an end to that,
he thinks now with a kind of sweet anger. He remembers standing at the comic rack for a while, spinning it idly to see if there were any new Batmans or Superboys, or his own favorite, Plastic Man. He had given his mother's list. She sent him to the drugstore, as other boys' mothers might send them to the corner grocery, and his mother's check to Mr. Keene.
He would fill the order and then write in the amount on the check, giving Eddie the receipt so she could deduct the amount from her checking balance. This was all SOP for Eddie. Three different kinds of prescription for his mother, plus a bottle of Geritol, because she told him mysteriously, "It's full of iron, Eddie, and women need more iron than men." Also, there would be his vitamins, a bottle of Dr. Sweat's elixir for children, and, of course, his asthma medicine. It was always the same. Later, he would stop in the Costello Avenue Market with his dollar and get two candy bars and a Pepsi. He would eat the candy, drink the soda, and jingle his pocket change all the way home. But this day was different. It would end with him in the hospital, and that was certainly different, but it started being different when Mr. Keene called him. Because instead of handing him the big white bag full of cures and the receipt, admonishing him to put the receipt in his pocket so he wouldn't lose it, Mr. Keene looked at him thoughtfully and said, "Come to back into the office for a minute, Eddie. I want to talk to you." Eddie only looked at him for a moment, blinking, a little scared. The idea that maybe Mr. Keene thought he had been shoplifting flashed briefly through his mind. There was that sign by the door that he always read when he came into the Center Street Drug. It was written in accusing black letters so large that he bet even Richie Tozier could read it without his glasses. Shoplifting is not a kick or a groove or a gasser. Shoplifting is a crime, and we will prosecute. Eddie had never shoplifted anything in his life, but that sign always made him feel guilty, made him feel as if Mr. Keene knew something about him that he didn't know about himself. Then Mr. Keene confused him even further by saying, "How about an ice cream soda?" "Well, oh, it's on the house. I always have one in the office around this time of day. Good energy, unless you need to watch your weight, and I'd say neither of us do. My wife says I look like a stuffed string. Your friend there, the Hanscom boy, he's the one who needs to have a care about his weight. What flavor, Eddie?"
"Well, my mother said to get home as soon as I..."
"You look like a chocolate man to me. Chocolate okay for you?" Mr. Keene's eyes twinkled, but it was a dry twinkle like the sun shining on mica in the desert. Or so Eddie, a fan of such Western writers as Max Brand and Archie Jocelyn, thought.
"Sure," Eddie gave in.
Something about the way Mr. Keene pushed his gold-rimmed glasses up on his blade of a nose made him edgy. Something about the way Mr. Keene seemed both nervous and secretly pleased. He didn't want to go into the office with Mr. Keene. This wasn't about a soda. Nope. And whatever it was about, Eddie had an idea. It wasn't such great news.
"Maybe he's going to tell me I got cancer or something," Eddie thought wildly. "That kid cancer, leukemia, Jesus."
"Oh, don't be so stupid," he answered himself back, trying to sound in his own mind like Stuttering Bill. Stuttering Bill had replaced Jock Mahoney, who played the Range Rider on TV's Saturday mornings, as the great hero of Eddie's life. In spite of the fact that he couldn't talk right, Big Bill always seemed to be on top of things.
"This guy's a pharmacist, not a doctor, for cripe's sake."
But Eddie was still nervous. Mr. Keene had raised the counter gate and was beckoning to Eddie with one bony finger. Eddie went, but reluctantly. Ruby, the counter girl, was sitting by the cash register and reading a silver screen.
"Would you make two ice cream sodas, Ruby?" Mr. Keene called to her. "One chocolate, one coffee?"
"Sure," Ruby said, marking her place in the magazine with a tinfoil gum wrapper and getting up.
"Bring them into the office."
"Sure."
"Come on, son, I'm not going to bite you."
And Mr. Keene actually winked, astounding Eddie completely. He had never been in back of the counter before, and he gazed at all the bottles and pills and jars with interest. He would have lingered if he had been on his own, examining Mr. Keene's mortar and pestle, his scales and weights, the fish bowls full of capsules. But Mr. Keene propelled him forward into the office and closed the door firmly behind him. When it clicked shut, Eddie felt a warning tightness in his chest and fought it. There would be a fresh aspirator in with his mother's things, and he could have a long, satisfying honk on it as soon as he was out of here. A bottle of licorice whip stood on the corner of Mr. Keene's desk. He offered it to Eddie.
"No, thank you," Eddie said politely.
Mr. Keene sat down in the swivel chair behind his desk and took one. Then he opened his drawer and took something out. He put it down next to the tall bottle of licorice whips, and Eddie felt real alarm course through him. It was an aspirator. Mr. Keene tilted back in his swivel chair until his head was almost touching the calendar on the wall behind him.
The picture on the calendar showed more pills. It said, Squib. And for one nightmare moment, when Mr. Keene opened his mouth to speak, Eddie remembered what had happened in the shoe store when he was just a little kid, when his mother had screamed at him for putting his foot in the X-ray machine. For that one nightmare moment, Eddie thought Mr. Keene would say, Eddie, 9 out of 10 doctors agree that asthma medicine gives you cancer, just like the X-ray machines they used to have in the shoe stores. You probably got it already. Just thought you ought to know. But what Mr. Keene did say was so peculiar that Eddie could think of no response at all. He could only sit in the straight wooden chair on the other side of Mr. Keene's desk like a nit. This has gone on long enough. Eddie opened his mouth and then closed it again. How old are you, Eddie? 11, isn't it? Yes, sir, Eddie said faintly. His breathing was indeed shallowing up. He wasn't yet whistling like a tea kettle, which was how Richie put it. Somebody turn Eddie off. He's reached the boil. But that might happen at any time. He looked longingly at the aspirator on Mr. Keene's desk, and because something else seemed required, he said, I'll be 12 in November. Mr. Keene nodded, then leaned forward like a TV pharmacist in a commercial and clasped his hands together. His eyeglasses gleamed in the strong light thrown by the overhead fluorescent bars. Do you know what a placebo is, Eddie? Nervously, taking his best guess, Eddie said, Those are the things on cows that the milk comes out of, aren't they? Mr. Keene laughed and rocked back in his chair. No, he said, and Eddie blushed to the roots of his flat-top haircut. Now he could hear the whistle creeping into his breathing. A placebo? He was interrupted by a brisk double tap at the door. Without waiting for a come-in call, Ruby entered with an old-fashioned ice cream soda glass in each hand. Yours must be the chocolate, she said to Eddie and gave him a grin. He returned it as best he could, but his interest in ice cream sodas was at its lowest ebb in his entire personal history. He felt scared in a way that was both vague and specific. It was the way he felt scared when he was sitting on Dr. Handor's examination table in his underpants, waiting for the doctor to come in, and knowing his mother was out in the waiting room, taking up most of one sofa. A book, most likely Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking, or Dr. Jarvis's Vermont Folk Medicine, held firmly up to her eyes like a hymnal. Stripped of his clothes and defenseless, he felt caught between the two of them. He sipped some of the soda as Ruby went out, hardly tasting it. Mr. Keene waited until the door was shut and then smiled his dry, sun-on-mica smile again. Loosen up, Eddie. I'm not going to bite you or hurt you. Eddie nodded, because Mr. Keene was a grown-up and you were supposed to agree with grown-ups at all costs. His mother had taught him that. But inside he was thinking, Oh, I've heard that bullshit before. It was about what the doctor said when he opened the sterilizer and the sharp, frightening smell of alcohol drifted out, stinging his nostrils. That was the smell of shots, and this was the smell of bullshit, and both came down to the same thing. When they said it was just going to be a little prick, something you hardly felt at all, that meant it was going to hurt plenty. He tried another half-hearted suck on his soda straw, but it was no good. He needed all the space in his narrowing throat just to suck in air. He looked at the aspirator sitting in the middle of Mr. Keene's blotter, wanted to ask for it, didn't quite dare. A weird thought occurred to him. Maybe Mr. Keene knew he wanted it, but didn't dare ask for it. That maybe Mr. Keene was torturing, teasing him. Except that was a really stupid idea, wasn't it? A grown-up, particularly a health-dispensing grown-up, wouldn't tease a little kid that way, would he? Surely not. It wasn't even to be considered, because consideration of such an idea might necessitate a terrifying reappraisal of the world as Eddie understood it. But there it was, so near and yet so far, like water just beyond the reach of a man who was dying of thirst in the desert. There it was, standing on the desk below Mr. Keene's smiling mica eyes. Eddie wished more than anything else that he was down in the barrens with his friends around him. The thought of a monster, some great monster, lurking under the city where he had been born and where he had grown up, using the sewers and drains to creep from place to place, that was a frightening thought. And the thought of actually fighting that creature, of taking it on, was even more frightening. But somehow this was worse. How could you fight a grown-up who said it wasn't going to hurt when you knew it was?
How could you fight a grown-up who asked you funny questions and said obscurely ominous things like, "This has gone on long enough"? And almost idly, in a kind of side thought, Eddie discovered one of his childhood's great truths. Grown-ups are the real monsters, he thought. It was no big deal, not a thought that came in a revelatory flash or announced itself with trumpets and bells. It just came and was gone, almost buried under the stronger overriding thought, "I want my aspirator and I want to be out of here." "Loosen up," Mr. Keene said again. "Most of your trouble, Eddie, comes from being so tight and stiff all the time. Take your asthma, for instance. Look here." Mr. Keene opened his desk drawer, fumbled around inside, and then brought out a balloon. Expanding his narrow chest as much as possible, his tie bobbed like a narrow boat riding a mild wave. He huffed into it and blew it up. "Center Street Drug," the balloon said. "Prescriptions, sundries, ostomy supplies." Mr. Keene pinched the balloon's rubber neck and held the balloon out in front of him. "Now pretend for just a moment that this is a lung," he said. "Your lung. I should really blow up two, of course, but since I only had one left from the sale we had just after Christmas..." "Mr. Keene, could I have my aspirator now?" Eddie's head was starting to pound. He could feel his windpipe sealing itself up. His heart rate was up and sweat stood out on his forehead. His chocolate ice cream soda stood on the corner of Mr. Keene's desk, the cherry on top sinking slowly into a goo of whipped cream. "In a minute," Mr. Keene said. "Pay attention, Eddie. I want to help you. It's time somebody did. If Russ Handor isn't man enough to do it, I'll have to. Your lung is like this balloon, except it's surrounded by a blanket of muscle. These muscles are like the arms of a man operating a bellows, you understand? In a healthy person, those muscles help the lungs to expand and contract easily. But if the owner of those healthy lungs is always getting stiff and tight, the muscles begin to work against the lungs rather than with them. Look." Mr. Keene wrapped a bunched, bony, liver-spotted hand around the balloon and squeezed. The balloon bulged over and under his fist, and Eddie winced, trying to get ready for the pop. Simultaneously, he felt his breathing stop altogether. He leaned over the desk and grabbed for the aspirator and the blotter. His shoulder struck the heavy ice cream soda glass. It toppled off the desk and shattered on the floor like a bomb. Eddie heard that only dimly. He was clawing the top off the aspirator, slamming the nozzle into his mouth, triggering it off. He took a tearing, heaving breath, his thoughts a rat run of panic, as they always were at moments like this. "Please, Mommy, I'm suffocating. I can't breathe. Oh, my dear God, oh, dear Jesus, meek and mild, I can't breathe. Please, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. Oh, please." Then the fog from the aspirator condensed on the swollen walls of his throat, and he could breathe again. "I'm sorry," he said, nearly crying. "I'm sorry about the glass. I'll clean it up and pay for it. Just please don't tell my mother, okay? I'm sorry, Mr. Keene, but I couldn't breathe." There was that double rap at the door again, and Ruby poked her head in. "Is everything..." "Everything's fine," Mr. Keene said sharply. "Leave us." "Well, I'm sorry," Ruby said. She rolled her eyes and closed the door. Eddie's breath was starting to whistle in his throat again. He took another pull at the aspirator and then began his fumbling apology once more. He ceased only when he saw that Mr. Keene was smiling at him, that peculiar dry smile. Mr. Keene's hands were laced over his middle. The balloon lay on his desk. A thought came to Eddie. He tried to hold it back and couldn't. Mr. Keene looked as if Eddie's asthma attack had tasted better to him than his half-finished coffee soda. "Don't be concerned," he said. "Ruby will clean up the mess later. And if you want to know the truth, I'm rather glad you broke the glass. Because I promised not to tell your mother that you broke it if you promised not to tell her we had this little talk." "Oh, I promised that," Eddie said eagerly. "Good," Mr. Keene said. "We have an understanding. And you feel much better now, don't you?" Eddie nodded. "Why?" "Why? Well, because I had my medicine." He looked at Mr. Keene the way he looked at Mrs. Casey in school when he had given an answer he wasn't quite sure of. "But you didn't have any medicine," Mr. Keene said. "You had a placebo." "A placebo, Eddie, is something that looks like medicine and tastes like medicine, but isn't medicine. A placebo isn't medicine because it has no active ingredients. Or if it is medicine, it's medicine of a very special sort, head medicine." Mr. Keene smiled. "Do you understand that, Eddie? Head medicine."
Eddie understood all right. Mr. Keene was telling him he was crazy. But through numb lips he said,
"No, I don't get you."
"Let me tell you a little story," Mr. Keene said. "In 1954, a series of medical tests on ulcer patients was run at DePaul University. 100 ulcer patients were given pills. They were all told the pills would help their ulcers. But 50 of the patients really got placebos. They were, in fact, M&Ms given a uniform pink coating." Mr. Keene uttered a strange, shrill giggle, that of a man describing a prank rather than an experiment. "Of those 100 patients, 93 said they felt a definite improvement, and 81 showed an improvement. So what do you think? What conclusion do you draw from such an experiment, Eddie?"
"I don't know," Eddie said faintly.
Mr. Keene tapped his head solemnly. "Most sickness starts in here, that's what I think. I've been in this business a long, long time, and I knew about placebos a mighty stretch of years before those doctors at DePaul University did their study. Usually it's old folks who end up getting the placebos. The old fellow or the old girl will go to the doctor convinced that they've got heart disease or cancer or diabetes or some damn thing. But in a good many cases, it's nothing like that at all. They don't feel good because they're old, that's all. But what's a doctor to do? Tell them they're like watches with worn-out mainsprings? Huh, not likely. Doctors like their fees too much." And now Mr. Keene's face wore an expression somewhere between a smile and a sneer. Eddie just sat there waiting for it to be over, to be over, to be over.
"You didn't have any medicine."
Those words clanged in his mind.
"The doctors don't tell them that, and I don't tell them that either. Why bother?
Sometimes an old party will come in with a prescription blank that will say it right out. Placebo, or 25 grains blue skies, which was how old Doc Pearson used to put it." Mr. Keene cackled briefly and then sucked on his coffee soda.
"Well, what's wrong with it?" he asked Eddie.
And when Eddie only sat there, Mr. Keene answered his own question.
"Why, nothing. Nothing at all.
At least, usually. Placebos are a blessing for old people. And then there are other cases. Folks with cancer, folks with degenerative heart disease, folks with terrible things that we don't understand yet. Some of them children just like you, Eddie. In cases like that, if a placebo makes the patient feel better, where is the harm? Do you see the harm, Eddie?"
"No, sir,"
Eddie said, and looked down at the splatter of chocolate ice cream, soda water, whipped cream, and broken glass on the floor. In the middle of all this was the maraschino cherry, as accusing as a blood clot at a crime scene. Looking at this mess made his chest feel tight again.
"Then we're like Ike and Mike. We think alike. 5 years ago, when Vernon Maitland had cancer of the esophagus, a painful, painful sort of cancer, and the doctors had run out of anything effective they could give him for his pain, I came by his hospital room with a bottle of sugar pills. He was a special friend, you see. And I said, 'Vern, these are special experimental pain pills. The doctor doesn't know I'm giving them to you, so for God's sake be careful and don't tattle on me. They might not work, but I think they will. Take no more than one a day, and only if the pain is especially bad.' He thanked me with tears in his eyes. Tears, Eddie. And they worked for him. Yes, they were only sugar pills, but they killed most of his pain. Because pain is here."
Solemnly, Mr. Keene tapped his head again.
Eddie said, "My medicine does so work."
"I know it does,"
Mr. Keene replied, and smiled a maddening, complacent, grown-up smile.
"It works on your chest because it works on your head. Hydrox, Eddie, is water with a dash of camphor thrown in to give it a medicine taste."
"No,"
Eddie said. His breath had begun to whistle again. Mr. Keene drank some of his soda, spooned some of the melting ice cream, and fastidiously wiped his chin with his handkerchief while Eddie used his aspirator again.
"I want to go now,"
Eddie said.
"Let me finish, please."
"No, I want to go. You've got your money and I want to go."
"Let me finish,"
Mr. Keene said, so forbiddingly that Eddie sat back in his chair. Grown-ups could be so hateful in their power sometimes, so hateful. "Part of the problem here is that your doctor, Russ Handor, is weak. And part of the problem is that your mother is determined you are ill. You, Eddie, have been caught in the middle."
"I'm not crazy,"
Eddie whispered, the words coming out in a bare husk. Mr. Keene's chair creaked like a monstrous cricket.
"What?" "I said I'm not crazy,"
Eddie shouted. Then immediately, a miserable blush rose into his face. Mr. Keene smiled.
Think what you like, that smile said. Think what you like, and I'll think what I like. All I'm telling you, Eddie, is that you're not physically ill. Your lungs don't have asthma. Your mind does.
You mean I'm crazy?
Mr. Keene leaned forward, looking at him intently over his folded hands.
I don't know, he said softly. Are you?
It's all a lie, Eddie cried, surprised the words came out so strongly from his tight chest. He was thinking of Bill, how Bill would react to such amazing charges. Bill would know what to say, stutter or not. Bill would know how to be brave.
All a great big lie. I do have asthma. I do.
Yes, Mr. Keene said, and now the dry smile had become a weird skeletal grin.
But who gave it to you, Eddie?
Eddie's brain thudded and whirled. Oh, he felt sick. He felt very sick. 4 years ago, in 1954, the same year as the DePaul tests, oddly enough, Dr. Handor began prescribing this Hydrox for you. That stands for hydrogen and oxygen, the two components of water. I have condoned this deception since then, but I will not condone it anymore. Your asthma medicine works on your mind rather than your body. Your asthma is the result of a nervous tightening of the diaphragm that is ordered by your mind or your mother.
You are not sick.
A terrible silence descended. Eddie sat in his chair, his mind whirling. For a moment he considered the possibility that Mr. Keene might be telling the truth, but there were ramifications in such an idea that he could not face. Yet why would Mr. Keene lie, especially about something so serious? Mr. Keene sat and smiled his bright, dry, heartless desert smile.
I do have asthma. I do.
The day that Henry Bowers punched me in the nose, the day Bill and I were trying to make a dam in the Barrens, I almost died. Am I supposed to think that my mind was just making all of that up?
But why would he lie?
It was only years later, in the library, that Eddie asked himself the more terrible question.
Why would he tell me the truth?
Dimly he heard Mr. Keene saying, I've kept my eye on you, Eddie. I told you all this because you're old enough to understand, but also because I've noticed you finally made some friends. They are good friends, aren't they?
Yes,
Eddie said. Mr. Keene tilted his chair back. It made that cricket-like noise again, and closed one eye in what might or might not have been a wink.
And I'll bet your mother doesn't like them much, does she?
She likes them fine, Eddie said, thinking of the cutting things his mother had said about Richie Tozier.
He has a foul mouth, and I've smelled his breath, Eddie. I think he smokes.
Her sniffing remark not to loan any money to Stan Uris because he was a Jew, her outright dislike of Bill Denbro and that fat boy. He repeated to Mr. Keene,
she likes them a lot.
Does she? Mr. Keene said, still smiling. Well, maybe she's right and maybe she's wrong, but at least you have friends. Maybe you ought to talk to them about this problem of yours, this mental weakness. See what they have to say. Eddie didn't reply. He was through talking to Mr. Keene. That seemed safer. And he was afraid that if he didn't get out of here soon, he really would cry. Well, Mr. Keene said, standing up, I think that just about finishes us up, Eddie. If I've upset you, I'm sorry. I was only doing my duty as I saw it. But before he could say any more, Eddie had snatched up his aspirator and the white bag of pills and nostrums and had fled. One of his feet skidded in the ice-creamy mess on the floor, and he almost fell. Then he was running, bolting from the Center Street drugstore in spite of his whistling breath. Ruby stared after him over her movie magazine, her mouth open. Behind him he seemed to sense Mr. Keene standing in the doorway of his office and watching his graceless retreat over the prescription counter, gaunt and neat and thoughtful and smiling. Smiling that dry desert smile. He paused outside on the three-way corner of Kansas, Main, and Center. He took another deep pull from his aspirator while sitting on the low stone wall by the bus stop. His throat was now positively slimy with that medicinal taste. Nothing but water with some camphor thrown in. And he thought that if he had to use the aspirator again today, he would probably puke his guts. He slipped it into his pocket and watched the traffic pass back and forth, headed up Main Street and down Up Mile Hill. He tried not to think. The sun beat down on his head, blaringly hot. Each passing car threw bright darts of reflection into his eyes, and a headache was starting in his temples. He couldn't find a way to stay angry at Mr. Keene, but he had no trouble at all feeling bad for Eddie Kasprak. He felt real bad for Eddie Kasprak.
He supposed that Bill Denbro never wasted time feeling sorry for himself. But Eddie just couldn't seem to help it. More than anything else, he wanted to do exactly what Mr. Keene had suggested. Go down to the Barons and tell his friends everything. See what they would say. Find out what answers they had. But he couldn't do that now. His mother would expect him home with her medicine soon.
Your mind or your mother?
And if he wasn't there,
your mother is determined you are ill.
Trouble would follow. She would assume he had been with Bill or Richie or the Jew boy, as she called Stan, insisting that she meant no prejudice by so calling him, but was simply slapping down the cards. Her phrase for truth-telling in difficult situations. And standing here on this corner, trying hopelessly to sort out his flying thoughts, Eddie knew what she would say if she knew one of his other friends was a Negro and another was a girl old enough to be getting bosoms. He started slowly toward Up Mile Hill, dreading the stiff climb in this heat. It felt almost hot enough to fry an egg on the sidewalk. For the first time, he found himself wishing for school to be in again, for a new grade and a new teacher's peculiarities to contend with, for this dreadful summer to be over. He stopped halfway up the hill, not far from where Bill Denbro would rediscover his bike Silver 27 years later, and pulled his aspirator from his pocket. Hydrox Mist, the label said. Administer as needed. Something else clicked home. Administer as needed. He was only a kid, still wet behind the ears, as his mother sometimes told him when she was slapping down the cards. But even a kid of 11 knew that you didn't give someone real medicine and then write on the label, administer as needed. If it was real medicine, it would be too easy to kill yourself as you went happy assholing around and administering as needed. He supposed you could kill yourself with plain old aspirin doing that. He looked fixedly at the aspirator, unaware of the old lady who glanced curiously at him as she passed on down the hill toward Main Street with her shopping basket over her arm. He felt betrayed, and for one moment he almost cast the plastic squeezed bottle into the gutter. Better yet, he thought, throw it down that sewer grating. Sure, why not? Let it have it down there in its tunnels and dripping sewer pipes. Have a placebo, you hundred-faced creep. He uttered a wild laugh and came within an ace of doing it. But in the end, habit was simply too strong. He replaced the aspirator in his right front pants pocket and walked on, hardly hearing the occasional blare of a horn or the diesel drone of the Basie Park bus as it passed him. He was likewise unaware of how close he was to discovering what being hurt, really hurt, was all about. 3. When he came out of the Costello Avenue Market 25 minutes later with a Pepsi in one hand and two payday candy bars in the other, Eddie was unpleasantly surprised to see Henry Bowers, Victor Chris, Moose Sadler, and Patrick Hochstetter kneeling on the crushed gravel to the left of the little store. For a moment, Eddie thought they were shooting craps. Then he saw they were pooling their money on Victor's baseball shirt. Their summer school textbooks lay off to one side in an untidy heap. On an ordinary day, Eddie might have simply faded quietly back into the store and asked Mr. Guidreau if he could leave by the back door, but this had been no ordinary day. Eddie froze right where he was instead, one hand still holding the screen door with its tin cigarette signs, Winston tastes good like a cigarette should, 21 great tobaccos make 20 wonderful smokes, the bellboy who was shouting, call for Philip Morris. The other clutching the brown grocery bag and the white drugstore bag. Victor Chris saw him and elbowed Henry. Henry looked up. So did Patrick Hochstetter. Moose, whose relays worked more slowly, went on counting out pennies for 5 seconds or so before the sudden silence sank into him and he also looked up. Henry stood, brushing loose pieces of gravel from the knees of the bibballs he was wearing. There were splints on the sides of his bandaged nose, and his voice had a nasal foghorning quality.
Well, I be go to hell, he said. One of the rock throwers. Where's your friends, asshole? They inside?